to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I am talking to Adrian Wooldridge. Adrian is the political editor of The Economist, where he also writes the weekly Beitshart column on British politics. He's the author of several books, and among them we can find subjects like the role of religion in American politics, globalization, the American management mania, and most recently he came out with a book together with Alan Greenspan on capitalism in America, a history. A few years ago, Adrian released a book together with John Micklethwaite on the Fourth Revolution, the global race to reinvent the state. The book is basically arguing that by mastering the art of government, the West dominated the world for 400 years. But now we've been for a decade or longer in a process where the West is rapidly unmastering that art of government. In April, Adrian and John penned a brilliant essay in Bloomberg where they used the book as a platform to engage in discussion about state performance and good government during the pandemic. And in that article, they go through state performance in Europe, North America, and perhaps more importantly, in East Asia. And they broadly make the argument that good government and state capacities in East Asia now are much better than in Europe and North America. We recorded this conversation during a Zoom online event that we had with Adrian in the middle of June, a seminar which was titled COVID-19 and Good Government. Can the West make the state competent again? You will hear that some people will ask questions during this session and that I, as a host, will also raise questions that people who participated in the event had passed on to me. All right. So as I said, the starting point for this seminar or this webinar is the pandemic and how it's put the light on good government and competent state action, or perhaps the lack thereof. Adrian, so let me start this conversation by asking you perhaps both an open and poignant question. Even if I don't want to pick on Britain, but 150 years ago, it could run an empire with a few hundreds of officials in London. But now the British government struggled to build a COVID tracing app. The United States, they remain a superpower with a military that is unrivaled in modern war technology and firepower. Yet it fails time and again with basic things like building a website for the healthcare system, let alone their failures with more important things like improving education in schools. So what's gone wrong with the state in the West? Why are we finding that many governments haven't been able to get basic state functions to work adequately during the pandemic?
I think the countries that are at the heart of the failure are exactly the ones that you mentioned, which are the United States and Great Britain. They're the countries that have performed not just badly, but much less well than one would have expected, given their history and their importance. You talked about the building of the tracing app. I think we have now unofficially in Britain today actually abandoned the attempt to build this tracing app. We were going to have it rolled out quite soon. We were going to have the Isle of Wight as a sort of experimental sense and as a centre. And suddenly the government has gone cold on this idea, saying that, well, it doesn't really work and we're going to have to use people instead. That's extraordinary given what's been going on in East Asia at the same time. So I think, you know, the title of our book is The Wake-Up Call. And I think this really is a wake-up call because it demonstrates how far behind we have fallen vis-a-vis certain significant sections of the world, and also really unexpectedly so. We would have thought of the United States and Great Britain as sort of superpowers when it comes to high technology. And it seems that, well, whatever if they're good at creating it, they're certainly not good at disseminating it and integrating it into their healthcare systems. And I would say that for a very significant length of time, we haven't taken the state particularly seriously in the West as something that needs to be built, maintained, nurtured, and constantly revised in the light of experience. So you have two sort of schools of attitudes, two sets of attitudes to the state. One is that you have people on the right who tend to think that the state is the enemy or certainly not really serious enough. So a lot of right-wing people, basically conservative people, would prefer to go into the private sector than the public sector. A lot of policy makers on the right think that their first instinct is to trim the state, cut it. They're worried about it being overwhelmingly large. On the left, you have exactly the opposite attitude, that the state can't be touched, can't be pruned. If you start pruning it, if you start reforming it, that's a signal that you're actually going to destroy it. So we have to preserve it exactly as it is, because the state achieved its most perfect form in 1945 and in the post-war settlement, and any attempt to change it fundamentally will undermine it. So I think both sides of the political aisle are ignoring the most important thing, which is what matters is not the size of the state, but the competence of the state. And what we need to be doing is not shrinking the state or getting rid of the state, because that's really not a mature way of looking at the modern economy, but reforming it and improving it, because without a functional state, we can't have a functional modern economy. And because you have this anti-state attitude on the right and pro-state attitude on the left, I think that's determined the sort of people that go into the public sector. You've had a very significant decline in the quality of people going into the public sector. You've also had people who possess very modern skills, technological skills, just abandoning the state. They go for reasons essentially to do with levels of reward. They go into the private sector. So the state isn't operating in the same world. It isn't operating with the same caliber of people that the private sector is. And we're seeing the consequences of that now with COVID.
So do you think that this ideological debate that you talked about, sort of on the one hand having sort of free market conservatives or right-wing people basically wanting to shrink the size of the state so they can drown it in a bathtub, to yes. quote one ideologue on that side of the argument. So, and on the other side, we have sort of left-wingers who are getting defensive every time you talk about state reforms, because they believe that you are now sort of trampling on cherished principles, and you inevitably want to sort of tear down the whole thing. Even if they also can admit that many of the basic principles that were behind the creation, especially of the welfare states from the Second World War onwards, like redistribution between rich and poor, between providing access to education and healthcare for people that couldn't afford it. A lot of people, even on the left, will admit that, well, we, you know, pretty much failing on many of these objectives as well, and sort of many of the societal problems that we're confronted with right now, they come from not necessarily caused by the state, but at least we thought that we had a state to actually correct them. So this has been the debate. But I get the sense from your argument that this basically has been sort of a sideshow, illusionary type of ideological debate, where we basically missed what is the critical part, that sort of if we want to live in an open, prosperous and secure society, we need to have a good state. And in order to have a good state, we need to focus on less of the ideology and sort of more of getting all these things to actually work.
Absolutely. Is that your case? Absolutely. I would say a classic example of this is what happened in our rather dismal election in Britain last December, when you had the main thrust of the Labour Party's argument was that the Tory party wanted to privatise the NHS. They wanted to sell off the NHS, primarily to the United States. And the Tory party responded to this accusation that it wanted to sell off the NHS. With the statement, no, we don't want to sell the NHS. We love it. We're going to keep it. We're going to add a few more hospitals. So we're going to make it bigger and better. But well, no, we're going to make it bigger, not that we're going to make it better. So any attempt to talk about structural reform of the NHS is always presented, but particularly by Jeremy Corbyn, as an attempt to privatise it, to sell it, to destroy it. So you had an incredibly inane debate about the National Health Service, which is now, of course, at the center of the issue of COVID. And it's very hard to get beyond that on issues of National Health Service or issues of welfare payments, because the very effective accusation of the left is always that you're a hard-faced capitalist who wants to go back to the middle of the 19th century. Of course, people don't want to go back to the workhouse or anything like that. But it's a very, very easy accusation to make. Now, the issue of the really important issues are issues of reform, issues of state capacity, issues of effectiveness, and they never seem to be at the center of at least our debates or at the center of debates in the United States. So I think that one of the consequences I hope will happen, which is what we're trying to say in the wake-up call, is we have to refashion our debate about the state to focus on capacity more than on redistribution, more than on expanding or on shrinking the state. This obsession with the size of the state is an extremely deceptive thing. So I think in some cases, in significant number of cases, there is a case for expanding the state, expanding the public sector. In other cases, there's a case for radically reducing the scope of the public sector. But that's because the focus should not be on size, it should be on effectiveness. And what can the state do that other institutions can't do?
Yep. So in the essay that you and John published a couple of months ago, you point to a couple of countries in East Asia, showing that they have been far more competent than many other governments in the world in responding to the pandemic. And this wasn't particularly surprising for someone who actually have read your book in the past, The Fourth Revolution, because you paint sort of a broader picture about a development where many of these East Asian countries have done a lot of things right in managing the state. They've, of course, also done things wrong, but they've also done a few things right. So now, looking at the COVID experience, what is it that they've done right in countries like South Korea, Japan, perhaps even, you know, China?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what people haven't noticed as much as they should have done is that there has been a new model of the state developing in Asia or in East Asia. And that model of the state is most comprehensive in Singapore, I think, because what Lee Kuan Yew, who's the architect of this system, did was to challenge some of the key principles of the Fabian state, of the post-war welfare state, that the state should be generous and that the state should be egalitarian. He didn't think it should be particularly generous. He think that people should make contributions into a national provident fund to their own old age, and that they should be conscious of making those contributions. He also thought that people should always be charged a small amount, but they should be charged for services, because the state shouldn't look as though it's being generous to people. It should look as though it's being responsible. Secondly, he didn't think the state should be egalitarian, particularly when it came to education. He thought the most important thing that you can do is to cultivate human capacities, which he believed to be were very different to different people. So these two central elements, generosity, egalitarianism, junked. But at the same time, he didn't accept the elements of the new Thatcherite state, which is that the state should be shrink, that it was basically unimportant. And he didn't accept that the state shouldn't play an active role in the economy. He believed that the state really, really mattered. So you shouldn't go around denigrating it in the way that Mrs. Thatcher and Ronald Reagan did. But at the same time, you had to give it a role in economic development. And he was constantly looking to put more resources to encourage companies, indigenous companies, to move up the value chain. So he didn't. What he didn't want was Singapore to become a sort of a local manufacturing center where all they were doing was using their hands. He wanted it to become a brain economy. So that's a very, very different model of the state, comprehensively different model of the state from the two models that prevailed in Europe after the Second World War. And I think that's very interesting. So that's my background. At the same time, you have, you know, various tigers developing in Asia, some going down that route, some a bit more skeptical of that route. Now you have one argument is that COVID was dealt with better in East Asia, or Asia more generally, because they had the experience of SARS, and they just knew what to do. And I think there's some truth in that. You know, they were closer to the problem, They're more serious about the problem immediately. So that's one excuse. But I think what we've constantly seen is that they also have bigger technological capacities than we ever expected, a greater ability to use their technology and their managerial abilities to deal with the problem. So in Taiwan, you had very, very rapid reaction, which involved using technology, using tracing, track and tracing methods very, very early on. You had the same thing in South Korea. You had the, to some extent, the same thing in China. So it's a very general thing that you have an efficient state that can act quickly, a state that has learned from a prior experience, which is the experience of COVID, and a state that can use technology to deliver services or to monitor its populations very quickly, because you have a very smart infrastructure, certainly in Singapore, parts of China, Taiwan. So, and just to give a sense of the differences that this means, in Seoul, which experienced the pandemic sooner than New York, in Seoul, and which is the same size as New York, in Seoul, by the end of, by June, by the beginning of June, you had 4 people who died of COVID. In New York City, you've had almost 22,000. So that's an astonishing difference, and that's very significantly down to state capacity.
Indeed, no, it is pretty astonishing. One thing that many of these countries, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, what's been thrown at them, especially from Western observers, is that their societies aren't really a society with a learning culture in the sense that you trial and you error, you learn from your mistakes, that you have sort of more of a punishing attitude to people that may do wrong or just make mistakes. My experience is different, and I take it from sort of your writings as well, that you don't really agree with this particular view of East Asian or Asian countries, that in fact what we're seeing there is that their space or their ability to actually learn from mistakes and to tolerate mistakes, to tolerate that you have to experiment, and when you experiment you make mistakes, that it's actually is greater than what you're going to find sort of in countries like America or most parts of Europe these days.
Well, I think that one of the problems, particularly with the public sector in Europe, is that it ceased to be very good at learning. It's not really a learning culture. There's a lot of buck passing. There's a lot of repetition of errors. And there's a lot of lack of communication between different bits of the public sector. And what's really striking about what happened in Asia is their ability to learn from what happened before. From SARS in particular, they seem to have taken those lessons, ingested them, and acted upon them extremely quickly. So it is a learning culture. It's a learning culture, particularly in the public sector. And one of the striking things, we haven't really talked as much as we should have done about China, because that's the big question, whether China is going to overtake the United States as a global power. One of the things that most interested me about this was their learning ability. They've done many, many things wrong in this pandemic, and they've been guilty of all sorts of things like suppressing information, all the things that are the opposite of being a learning culture. But if you look at the way that they reacted back at the turn of the century to SARS, and if you look at the way that they've reacted to COVID, it's much, much better. It's almost in a different league this time around. The way that they monitored the disease in hospitals, the way that they've published evidence globally, the way that they've set scientists to work on it, and the way that they've learned to respond very rapidly to outbreaks. Again, it's, you know, they've made mistakes, but the mistakes they've made this time around are much less than the mistakes they made last time around in 2000. So they are constantly learning and constantly evolving. Of course, they have this authoritarian instinct to suppress information. But at the same time, there's another side of China, which is that of a rapidly developing learning machine.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. There is this debate, I don't know how you think of it, between, on the one hand, you have sort of the state authoritarianism of China. You have the sort of the officials, the representatives of the states that are going to punish people that may express opinions that are not exactly appreciated by the government. And we saw sort of in the beginning of this pandemic with a doctor who was trying to alarm everyone to what's going on, he received a very harsh reaction. On the other hand, when you look at a lot of the behavior, and now I'm stepping away from the pandemic, when you look at a lot of the behavior by the Chinese state institutions in local matters, you will find sort of that what strikes you is not always sort of the authoritarianism of it. It's more sort of the flexibility of it, how they are keen sort of to be agile, to make decisions quickly if it's necessary in order to get things done. And I wonder sort of if this development itself is going to sort of, if there's going to be a conflict between them, because it is difficult over the long period of time to sustain sort of a degree of flexibility and learning and adjustability at local levels, that you can move very quickly. Sort of if someone applies for a license to build a chemical factory, then you can make a decision the next day. But on the other hand, sort of if someone wants to express an opinion which is critical of the current government, you're going to shut things down. At some point, sort of these two cultures are going to collide. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, I agree. I would also say, you know, you've got a huge country like China with a very complicated government with lots and lots of different levels of government. You can always find examples of inflexibility and examples of corruption. Those things matter, but I think a lot of what we should be focused on is the level, is the direction of travel. And I think what I've seen comparing reactions to earlier pandemics to this pandemic is a sort of move towards greater ability to confront reality rather than trying to bury and suppress reality. So that would, from the point of view of competitiveness, I think that should be worrying to the West. I also agree, in the longer term, can you have a culture that is both deferential to authority, unquestioningly over political issues, but willing to question things over operational issues and over scientific experiments and things like that? I'm not sure that it's possible, but I wouldn't bet my entire house that it will never happen. So you could get a peculiar new sort of state structure, which is simultaneously authoritarian and flexible, which is simultaneously top-down but capable of learning things, and which can use things like big data to gather huge amounts of information on people's behavior. It may be the case that that liberal democracy is not the only way that we can go. And again, that's one of the great questions which comes from this pandemic. So I wouldn't say, of course I wouldn't say, you know, in all sorts of ways, China's response to this pandemic has been appalling and bad. And in all sorts of ways, it's reflected certain fundamental weaknesses in the system. But that the gap between China and the United States in particular is not one that reflects well on the United States.
Yeah. A final question on Asia before we get back to Europe again. So in the book that you and John wrote, The Fourth Revolution, you open with some reflections that you had about an experience in China when you visited the China Executive Leadership Academy in Shanghai, which is basically a training school for Chinese state officials where they learn the practice of executive state leadership. You call it in the book China's Kennedy School of Government, like the one at Harvard. But what to me looked striking sort of was that, and I've been there myself, is that sort of at the academy, they don't really offer programs in sort of the theory of government. They teach official how actually to run things, how to build things, and how to get a project to finish on time and on budget. Yeah. I wonder, is this what we're missing in the West, sort of with, you talked about sort of the sort of the labor problem we have with the people that get into government, that it's not always the case that we pay them too little or that the working environment is poor. It may be just that we're attracting a type of individual that may not be particularly equipped to be executive. So we get some rather sort of an overeducated cadre of government officials that are versatile in the philosophy of Plato, but that are afraid of actually making decisions and being executive.
I have to be very careful in my answer to this, because I think you're right, absolutely. And if you go to the Kennedy School of Government, you have all sorts of things on the theory of the presidency, or even some interesting things about how elections operate. And you know, there are lots of people there who spend their life advising people on elections and how to win elections. What you don't get is anybody talking about how to run the budget of a town hall, or how to get a project delivered on time. And it's almost as though, you know, they're talking about the theory of the motor car rather than, you know, where the battery goes and where the wheels go, and that sort of thing. So I think that this focus on the mechanics of government is absolutely a big source of their advantage. However, I would say that the sort of problem that the West is confronted with at the moment with government is not just a technical problem, you know, how can we get it to work a bit better? It's also a theoretical problem. It's also a problem of, you know, what is the state for? What should the state do and what shouldn't it do? What is a leadership class? How should you educate a leadership class? How should a leadership class be making decisions? So I'm a great fan of Plato. And I think, you know, if our leaders read more Plato, we'd be in a much better better position. So I sort of, in a sense, you know, I'm happy with people reading Plato. I'm happy with people learning how to service the engine of a car and to put the new battery in. It's the middle area that we've got too much of. You know, I think we need both a more practical leadership class, and also a leadership class that's capable of asking some bigger questions, particularly I think when it comes to thinking about the future. But definitely that leadership school is a really interesting contrast with our own schools of leadership, which are around us the middle level rather than the two levels which we just talked about.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to Europe now, Adrian. So yeah. It's not all European governments and all European states that have failed during the pandemic, and actually some states that have performed pretty well. Which are these states, and why did they perform well?
Well, the obvious state that has done well is Germany. And I almost feel like saying Germany's done well at this, because rather annoyingly, Germany tends to do quite well at all sorts of things. But I think they've been sensible, methodical. They have structural advantages in that they're really quite decentralized. They don't have this gigantic capital city that Britain has dominated the whole of the country. They have a very sensible leader in Angela Merkel, whose pragmatic view of the world has been, you know, it's playing to her strengths there. They have much more sort of inbuilt surpluses, redundancies, as it were. They've got more beds in their health service. You know, we run our health service very hot, so there's very little spare capacity. They've got more spare capacity. So they're one example, I think. And they've tended different elements in the government and civil society seem to have worked well together. I think the same is true of Switzerland, some of the Nordic countries. I think you might talk yourself about Sweden, which is an interesting example. I think Iceland has done well during this thing, but tiny population. France, not particularly well, but a bit better than Britain. Italy, not particularly well, although brought a very raging pandemic now under control quite well. In a sense, it's the countries that you would expect to do well, the well-governed countries. But also there's some interesting examples of countries you wouldn't expect to have done well, which is, I think, Greece is an interesting example, which has managed the pandemic really quite well, and it's learned a bit from the chaos that it went through before. It does this as an example that it's much more mature in the way that it's running itself than it was a few years ago. Interesting examples, but with the exception probably of Greece, not entirely surprising. Governments that have taken government seriously and that haven't been paralyzed by partisanship have tended to do the best. And I think there are various elements that matter. There's the element of leadership, there's the element of systems, of structures, and there's the element of trust. And what we have in Britain, in particular, I would say, is a leadership that hasn't performed very well, partly because it's the product of almost a decade now of very severe partisanship and political infighting. And we don't have a system in which there's very good trust. People don't trust the government to do the right thing, and they don't tend to obey as much as they would if they trusted the government. So the systems, the National Health Service is middling in terms of systems. And I think in Germany, much, much higher levels of trust in authority.
What do you make of the argument that at least some of the countries that you mentioned, Germany, Switzerland, they're also federal structures, and yes, they had local authorities basically taking charge over things much sooner than the federal government stepped in, and there's sort of a closer relation between your local government, then you have a closer relation with the local government than you have with the federal government. Sort of generally, is there something to this when it comes to state capacity? And I mean, sort of beyond the pandemic, that federal structures tend to operate better than more centralized states?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the tragedies of what's been happening in Britain in the last few years is we have, you know, what was a very, very centralized government, in which government has taken over more and more functions, more and more responsibilities, wanted to do everything and monitor everything. That's led both to a government that's overloaded and rather dysfunctional, but also to massive resentments in the population. That's really what produced Brexit. So centralization, you know, is a long-term source of dysfunction. And yes, I would say that federalism. And of course, well, we'll talk probably later about the United States, but again, you know, the federalism there saved it from an even worse performance than we've had.
Exactly. And taking it to America and to some sense to Europe as well, because one development that I think happened pretty quickly during the pandemic sort of is that the structures of the culture war started to feast upon the politics of the pandemic, and we suddenly sort of got this highly polarized discussion. I mean, we saw that in America with, you know, a president who was, you know, effectively became an onlooker because he couldn't make up his mind whether he was in favor of lockdowns or against lockdowns. And then he was, you know, trying to cheer, you know, different protesters on if they wanted to sort of take the guns and move on sort of the state hall. And but even sort of, you know, if you look at the UK, if you look at France, you can see sort of these patterns of the culture war manifesting themselves in also the debate around the pandemic. So is this the sort of effect of the polarized political culture that we have so few in the middle now and so little that connects this stream? Sort of there's a few of us that actually can accept, even if we don't like all the thing, we can at least accept it because they will have some connection to what we believe or what we think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the culture wars did two things. First of all, they meant that we were probably pretty unprepared in those countries that have had culture wars for the pandemic. That if you look at America and the United Kingdom principally, also France a little bit, they've suffered from such polarization and such polarization and such intense controversy over cultural issues, identity issues, that they haven't really focused on the business, the boring business, actually, the being competent at governing things, you know, governing things, running things, making sure people work is not as exciting, it's not as adrenaline pumping as arguing about personal identity and things like that. But those arguments about personal identity take up a lot of air, take up a lot of time, and they create sort of cycles of revenge. So one of the things you've seen with Trump is that Trump has wanted to run down everything that Obama did, just as Obama wanted to run down things that George W. Bush did. And so you haven't had any consistency of policymaking, particularly on big existential issues like pandemics and climate change. You're constantly changing that. So not enough preparedness because of culture wars. And then we had this brief period, certainly in Britain, less in the United States, but certainly in Britain, which everybody rallied around the flag. And I remember reading articles, I don't even know if perhaps I even wrote some of these articles, saying the culture wars are over, where everything's about competence, you know, we're not fighting each other about you know, trans issues or race issues. That's all finished. That was all yesterday. And suddenly these things roared back very, very, very quickly. Obviously because of the George Floyd thing, but also because competent government is not what people want to talk about. People want to talk about more exciting things. And they've been in lockdown for a long period of time. So once you've been in lockdown for a long period of time, it's much more tempting to protest about things than it to say, let's have a really careful look at how the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Healthcare actually operates. So the culture wars, you know, are really flaring up again, and they're making it very difficult for us to deal with the consequences of the pandemic. They're also actually making us making it very, very difficult to look at the sort of look at some of the deeper causes of injustices which the, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing has exposed. Because if you think, who are the people who really suffer most from the dysfunctional nature of the American state? They're minorities, poor people in general, but minorities in particular. They're the people who are getting the worst of the American state. And if they to have a better life, we have to really look at the way that the state operates. But when it becomes a culture war and a war of absolutes, one sort of loses touch with all of these things. But there they are. We're back in the culture war in a major way.
Yeah. So I want to ask, which is a historical question, and this was also raised by one of the participants now who sent it to me. So the book is about the fourth revolution, sort of the past book. It's the fourth revolution of the state. Yeah. So what was revolution 1, 2, and 3? And why? What did they do, and why did they matter to the function of the state?
Sure. But the argument in our last book was essentially that the West leapt ahead from the rest of the world because it managed to introduce three big revolutions in the way that the world, the way that government works. If you go back to 1600, China was well ahead of the West. You could probably say that Mughal India was ahead of the West. You could certainly say that Turkey was ahead of the West. You know, the biggest centers of civilization, of population, of government machines were not in the West. And then what the West did was to go through a series of revolutions. The first revolution was a revolution I associated with Thomas Hobbes, which is a revolution that says what the state must do is provide people with security. That's what Hobbes is all about, you know. Build Leviathan in order to stop people from killing each other, essentially. And the West does that relatively successfully in that it creates political machines internally which can keep law and order. At the same time, it builds armies, which mean that it can project its power abroad. So you get Leviathans, lots of competing Leviathans built in the West. The second revolution, it comes from the late 18th and 19th centuries, which is essentially the liberal revolution, which says that what we must do is build states that are efficient and that also look to issues such as personal freedom. So it's not enough just to have a state that can preserve law and order. We need to have a state that can do all of its functions efficiently and that can preserve a certain degree of freedom for individuals so that they can pursue their own ends. And we associate that with John Stuart Mill, who is both a government reformer and a person who put liberty at the center of life. So you have this construction of the night watchman state. So you have the Leviathan. Leviathan gets a bit fat and a bit self-indulgent. Against that, you get the night watchman state that comes in the middle of the 19th century. Then at the beginning of the 20th century, you get people saying, well, it's all very well to have a night watchman state, but what about education? What about healthcare? What about looking after the poor? So you get the construction of the Fabian states, you know, the state of Sidney and Beatrice Webb, which says you've got to provide people with a minimum, at least, of healthcare, a minimum of education, which has to take care of its population. That's, again, reinterpreting security in a much broader sense of security from all the terrible things that can happen in life. And that's the sort of model that we've seen of the state, you know, since the early 20th century. I mean, most, you know, most gloriously, almost extravagantly, of course, in Sweden. Those are the three revolutions. And while we in the West had this perpetual reinvention of the state, what happened in the East, particularly in China, was that the state ossified. So in 1600, the greatest civil service in the world, the greatest state system in the world, running a gigantic country, really incredibly efficiently in many ways, has this fantastic Mandarin class, which is selected by the most rigorous examinations in the world from the whole of the continent. And that state just ossifies. It doesn't change. So if you were doing an exam in 1905 for to become a Mandarin civil servant, you could use a textbook which came from the 16th century. And you still, the questions were essentially the same. So that was a long process of ossification. So that's an enormous area in which the West reinvented itself and pulled ahead of the East, particularly China. Now, what's happened in the last few years, since I would say the 60s and 70s, is that we have become the ossified people. We've become the people who haven't reinvented our state. We've just accepted the state structure. We've allowed to get it to get bigger. We've allowed to get it more extravagant, but we haven't really fundamentally rejigged it in the light of a new world. Whereas the Chinese, the Singaporeans, many people in East Asia, are going through exactly the sorts of revolutions that the West went through. They take the state seriously, and they're building state capacity very quickly because they think that they can't have successful capitalist economies without having this state capacity. So I would have said, in 2000, let's say, the year 2000, probably the state is better in the West on average than it is in East Asia on average. I think what's really interesting about COVID, one of the many really interesting things about COVID, is that it seems to reveal to me that the state capacity in East Asia has actually pulled significantly ahead of state capacity here. That's why we call this book the wake-up call, because actually we've ignored about three alarms, and we're now snoozing on almost till lunchtime, almost till it's too late for us to go through another big process of reform, you know.
All right, very good. We are now going to take a few more questions also directly from the audience here. I'm going to invite Graham Mather to ask your question right away. Graham, you are now allowed to speak. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you, Frederick, and hello, Adrian.
Hello, Graham. Hi.
I'd like to just follow your scorecard of European countries with a group you didn't mention. The Austria of Sebastian Kurz and all the sort of former Habsburg countries also score well, even better than Germany, actually. And yet they aren't as touchy-feely, pragmatic, moderate, consensual. I just wondered if there was anything interesting to say about that group. My second point, if I could just bolster another quick one. On your very important point about the skills and capacity gap between public and private sector, how do we, the various attempts to get the private sector into partnership with government, financially, as contractors, as consultants, in franchises and things, all seem to have failed. Do you have can you point us to how we might actually bridge that gap?
Two very good questions. I'm not sure that I can answer the first. I would say that Austria, the Habsburg countries, have this tradition. They're not touchy-feely in the way that some way that Germany is, but they're pragmatic. They're very keen on engineering, vocational education, manufacturing industries and things like that. That gives them a sort of pragmatic engineering sort of mindset. Quite interesting that you have the same engineering mindset in China, which I think has helped to for them to be successful, but they also have a culture of trust, I think. And I think the two countries that have done worse, the United States and Britain, do have a real problem with trust, which is related to their partisanship. On the issue of the contractors, I think quite often it's the case, how can I say it without being too rude about some contractors? The contractors have quite often taken advantage of what they might regard as slightly naive people in the public sector. You haven't got enough people in the public sector who are good at defining the terms of contracts and making sure that the contracts work in the public sector's interests. I think the issue of the tram in Edinburgh is a particularly fine example of this, where whereby the contract was written in such a way that if it was late, the people who bore the cost of the lateness were not the people who were providing the building the tram, but the city council in Edinburgh. So of course it was incredibly late as a result of that. So I would say that you need better people at providing the contract front. And I would say the other thing that's happened, and I'm broadly in favour of bringing private sector skills into the public sector, but what you've seen is an attempt by the public sector to conceal its size by contracting things out. So it's contracted things out not as a sort of out of a really systematic theory of government, how government could be better, but because they said, well, we can't make government any bigger, so let's put everything off the books, or let's employ lots of private contractors to do things rather than getting civil servants to do things. I think the absolute size of the number of civil servants in America hasn't increased for about the last 20 or 30 years because they've put everything out to contract in various ways. It's a way of concealing the size of government rather than achieving certain ends. So it's again contracting. You know, one of the big problems, one of the reasons that I said that we need to be asking some fundamental questions: what is government for? Are there certain things that we could just stop it doing? We haven't done that. The bringing in contractors has been another way of allowing it to sprawl in a rather unaccountable way, so we don't have to confront bigger questions as to whether it should be doing a lot of what it's doing in the first place.
Thank you.
All right, Hugh, thank you very much. There's another question which was put to me. You've also just now, Adrian, but also previously, you've referenced sort of that more philosophical point, which is asking the question, what is the state for? So, Adrian, what is the state for?
A very, very big, question. I'm really tempted that we have to go back to Hobbes, that the state is fundamentally for providing security. And Hobbes thought the state was providing security from our natural tendency to violence, to attacking each other for egotistical advantage. I would slightly broaden that question and say it's to provide security from lots and lots of different threats, of which a pandemic threat is an important one. But this should be at the very heart of what states are for: security from outside attacks, law and order at home, security from pandemics. And I would say that the interesting thing about the Fabians in the early 20th century was they're also very preoccupied by security. The state should provide you with security in the form of guaranteed education, guaranteed healthcare, guaranteed pensions, because they protect you from certain risks. So the state is about security, it's about risk pooling and things like that. And I think we need to be really focused on that thing. And I think it's quite striking that we had lots and lots and lots of warnings about pandemics, flu pandemics or coronavirus pandemics, and we didn't really focus on them anything like enough because there was all this noise about all the rest of what the state's supposed to be doing. So I put security right at the center of that. So that's what the state is fundamentally for. And I think that's, you know, one of my worries about the size of the state is that when the state gets too big, it's not just so much that it costs us money and it's taxes, it's that it distracts attention. You know, if the state is trying to do everything, it ends up not focusing on the things that it's really supposed to be doing. So I think that what we've seen is that the Fabian state of the early 20th century just sprawled. It got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it got all omnivorous in what it was supposed to do. So I'd pull it back a little bit. But it's not just what the state is, what is the state for. I'm a great fan of Plato in this, so I want to bring Plato back to this. I think one of the issues is that we've been unclear about what the state is for, and because of that, we've allowed it to sprawl. But also, particularly on the right, we've been unclear that the state is actually, in the end, a good thing. That it's the state that preserves us from barbarism. It's the state that preserves, you know, but he has this metaphor of the ship, you know, unless the ship of state is kept in good order, you're going to hit the rocks, you're going to be drowned and things like that. So the state is absolutely essential to any civilized society. It's not an imposition. It's something that is collectively incredibly valuable. It's a collective good. And because it's so collectively valuable, because it's a collective good, the people who run the state are important people. They're also people that we should in some sense cherish, that we should We should have the best of our people going into the government, and that should be a very, very high calling. And what we have at the moment is, in many ways, not the best people going into it. Also, we don't treat them very well. We subject them to ridicule and booing, and we just assume that the worst of what people are doing. So instead of having, you know, a guardian class of people who are carefully selected and who are admired for what they're doing, we have a class of professional politicians who are slightly odd people in many ways, and who we rather despise for doing what they're doing. And I there are lots of ways in which I don't want to go back to the earlier parts of the 20th century when politicians were revered. They were very unrepresentative of the population. They tended to be rich. They were white. They were men, and all of that sort of thing. Nevertheless, a sense that politics is a high calling, not a low calling, is a big cultural change, which I think we need to have.
All right. Two comments from people. Then I'm going to ask you another question about the future. So one comment, and both are on this issue of federalism. Comment sort of is that when you looked at the German experience, especially the logistics of getting mass testing rolled out at a very early phase, it was basically sort of something driven by the private sector together with local authorities, and sort of you get private public collaborations of a kind that work. Another comment is more specific to Belgium, which is that if federalism was a factor of better management of COVID, how and where would you place Belgium, which is evaluated as some of the worst in handling the virus? I'd like to comment on Belgium.
I would say on the issue of the public-private collaboration, one of the interesting things about Germany is that it's actually really quite good at public-private collaboration, especially in this, and that it was very much more willing to allow the private sector to act than Britain, which is supposed to be more into that sort of thing. And we had this peculiar situation in Britain where an organization called Public Health England basically said, we can't have any private sector stuff, we'll do it all ourselves. And then they proceeded to do it all themselves very badly. So we then had to bring in the private sector. It turned out that there were quite a lot of tests available in university labs, in private industry labs, and the Public Health England had simply written these out of the equation. So you've got this sort of the sense with Public Health England that it's a justified monopoly in their mind, and we couldn't be looking anywhere else. Also, of course, Germany has a much bigger base in terms of its chemical industry. So it had a lot more of this stuff, the reagents, the testing capacity. We haven't. And I think this raises quite fundamental questions about how far you go with globalization. Are we going to go back to a world in which state capacity is also defined as including the ability to produce your own pharmaceuticals, that you're not dependent on the global market, your own testing and tracing abilities? And I think that's a legitimate question to have, because, you know, because we, Britain, which is massively dependent on imports, ended up at the back of the queue. So there is a case for producing some of these things. On the Belgian question, I really don't know enough about the details to know. I know that all I can say is that there may be good federalism and bad federalism, and bad federalism is bad. Just because you're federalist doesn't mean that you're virtuous in itself.
Yeah. And speaking on that point about Britain learning from Germany, you also make the point, I think it's in the book, it may be in the essay, that Britain has been trying to find ways to imitate the German vocational training system for more than 100 years. That you still haven't found a way to do it. So it's perhaps a good example of
Well, I think it's a very interesting example as well. And going back to something that Graham said earlier, that in Britain, that you tend to have this sort of mindset, which is you tend to divide people into different classes. There are the sort of theoretical, abstract people. Then there are the sort of mechanical, horny-handed sons of toil. We're quite good at the theoretical, abstract stuff, but we don't select people for the more vocational stuff, and we don't value them all, vocational stuff. So we can produce big schemes for government reform. What we can't do is implement them or think about the things that they're thinking about in CPAC, which is, you know, how do you manage a project? How do you reward people properly and things like that? And again, the vocational education system is an absolutely extraordinary failure. And one of the tragedies of this period with COVID is that this government, partly because of the impulse of the referendum and Brexit, was, I think, getting really serious about improving the quality of vocational education and shifting resources away from the university sector to the vocational educational sector, because so many people who voted for them, for tourism, for the first time ever in the north of England, felt cheated by the system. And that has rather been put into abeyance now because of the COVID disaster. But this thing that you see in Germany and Austria of a sort of pragmatic, detail-oriented, very calm, methodical mindset, you don't see as much of that as you do in Britain. And I think that helps to explain why they've been really quite good at this sort of at dealing with this pandemic.
Finally, Adrian, we're now getting to 4 o'clock. We're going to soon, but this is a question that I wanted to ask, and several people have also asked me to ask you, which is basically, can the West reinvent the state, given that we now, you know, confronted with, you know, pretty strong political challenges? We have a growing part of the population that are elderly, that are going to require pensions, elderly healthcare, which is going to put a lot of pressure financially and fiscally on society. We're confronted with climate change, or trying to address problems around social injustices, not being able to provide for good education to people so that they can improve their life chances. Is it that type of challenges that are going to force us to change, or are there sort of outside factors like sort of the rise of China and the fact that they may present a security problem to Europe? Should we rather look to these type of factors that can prompt us to change?
Well, it's very, very late. And I think what COVID has demonstrated very clearly is it's much later than we think. I don't think we expected at the start of this thing, that we would be looking to South Korea and Taiwan and thinking, God, they're much better at us than we are at these things. And I think there's a virtue in that. I think we've begun to recognize how far behind we've fallen in certain vital areas. So it's very late, and I think in many ways it's very difficult, because demographically it's difficult. We have a rapidly aging population. The quality of education, particularly for the lower half of the population, has been deteriorating for a very long time. And we have a culture which is very set against many of the things which I think that we need to do to reform our state system. We have to be a bit less generous in some ways, and we have to be a lot more elitist in other ways. And those are all culturally things that there's a lot of resistance to. But I would nevertheless say that crisis can mean opportunity. Crisis certainly means pressure for change. I think if we don't change our welfare system and our healthcare system, we will be overwhelmed by demographic change. So there's huge pressure to change things there. Pressure and competition from China will also push us very hard. Remember the last time that we had a really serious sort of state system in the United States was during the Cold War, when you just had this relentless pressure from Russia. You had you had Sputnik and the rest of it, which really forced them to become a little less flabby. So competition can be a good thing. And I do also think that we've had this crazed culture war. We haven't talked very much about Donald Trump, but he is a central problem here. We are likely to get a more sensible president in the United States, a president who governs from the center, and a president I think who might, or his people around him, might be capable of bringing the country together to some extent around the notion that there's a lot of things that really need to be fixed in this country, and we can't fix them just by constantly fighting each other. We have to have an agenda of reform. So, you know, we've seen in the West a whole series of crises which eventually have led to solutions. You know, we saw the 1930s when the economy was falling apart. There was a period of reconstruction after that. After the 1970s, there was a period of regeneration. I hope that we can follow it with the same, but it is very, very late in the day to escape from our morass.
So in essence, the situation has become so bad that we don't have that many options left, do we? I mean, reform.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that is right. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Adrian. This has been a fantastic hour of education and inspiration. Thank you so much to everyone who joined us here or have been listening to us through our broadcasting. I hope you also like this seminar as much as I did. Welcome back to ESIP. But Adrian, thank you so much for taking
the time. Thank you very much.